On today's episode of Open Kwong Door, author, writer, journalist, Beverly Smith.
Okay, it's rolling.
It's rolling, people.
I got nothing. I don't know what to say.
Welcome to Open... start that one again. Got a chance to interview Bev Smith, who has been a writer with the Globe and Mail since 1978. And you know what? It was something that I really wanted to do because everybody who reads Bev Smith really is familiar with her stories. I didn't think that really people were necessarily familiar with her story, and that was what kind of intrigued me.
Well, again, it's always we've done this a few times now where we grab somebody for an interview that is a broadcaster or somebody that is always telling other people's stories, and they, because they've been involved in all these different stories, they've had all these interesting experiences and often have a really good story of their own. So it's sort of nice to hear, you know, a little bit behind the scenes with these people that are storytellers themselves, having to sort of turn the camera or microphone as it is onto them a little bit.
Well, and it's interesting to catch somebody as they're entering a new phase of their life. So she's sort of branching out on her own, and it'll be interesting to see what she does. I mean, she has already written 4 figure skating books, says that she has another one in the works, hopefully will be published in the next little while. And then there was a book that she co-authored about the Queen's Plate. So she has a lot of standing and a lot of credibility in sports, and has throughout the length of her career. So a very, very interesting interview. So I'll be interested to see what you think. This is Beverly Smith. Well, my guest is the gold standard in sports journalism. She's covered a wide range of sports, including horse racing, show jumping, Olympic summer and winter sports, and since 1980, figure skating, winning numerous awards along the way. A well-established and successful author with 5 books to her credit, 4 of which are on figure skating. When the athletes aren't talking to anybody, they will still talk to her. Beverly Smith, thank you so much for coming in to talk to me today.
Pleased to be here.
Okay, so what I want to know, I've got a whole series of questions. Why did you want to be a writer?
Well, when I was, do you really want to know? When I was 10 years old, I saw a Northern Dancer win the Kentucky Derby.
On television?
And on TV. Mm-hmm. And I was just old enough to understand what that meant. And I became a horse racing fan that day. But about the same time, I read a book on the Black Stallion, and it was marvelously told. And I thought, I put the two things together and thought, why don't I start writing books? So I started writing books, and I started writing all the races on TV. And they became quite elaborate. I would design them myself, and I'd illustrate them, and I'd do the covers, and some of the covers would be my brother's wallpaper and bits of scraps and yarn twirled around, and the books got me my job at the Globe and Mail.
So when did you start at Globe and Mail?
I started in 1978. I hate to say that, but yep.
So your books that you'd produced yourself, you were the original self-publisher.
Well, I had a publisher.
Oh, but did you?
I decided, okay. I usually did my books with McClellan and Stewart.
So are we talking about when you were young?
Oh, yes. I'm talking about, these are unpublished books. These are like when I was public school, high school, spent all my spare time doing them, illustrated them, learned how to type doing it because I come from a town of 400. There's nothing there. There's just, high school had 93 kids in it when I was grade 13.
And this is Western Ontario?
This is Western Ontario. This is Bruce County.
Okay.
This is Kincardine area.
Mm-hmm.
That's my home stock. I was born in Kincardine Hospital.
Wow.
And yes, it was quite small potatoes. And I never ever thought that I'd ever see a horse race at Woodbine. I just watched everything on TV. And there was a lot on CBC. CBC showed everything back when I was young. I never missed anything. I had to make my family shut up when the races were on. And it sort of snowballed. So it began as horse racing. Everything began as horse racing.
So when you were young and you're from a small town, there's obviously lots of agriculture in that area. Are you from a farm? Did you have firsthand experience with horses, or did you just love them because of
nothing?
Nothing.
It was just Northern Dancer. Northern Dancer on TV. And you know what? My grandparents had a little sort of farm out near a swamp, and my parents live, and they still live in the house, about 3 acres outside of Ripley, Ontario, and they're still there. They're 80, both of them. And,
wow.
They grew up, you know, a few miles from each other and have been married 60 years. And my family is all up there, and I'm the only one that left. I'm sort of the oddball. I'm the oddball.
So what did they think of, what did they imagine, if you could put yourself in your mother's head, what did she imagine that little Beverly was going to do when she grew up?
Not too sure, because when I was grade 8, I said to Mom, you know, Mom, I want to go to university. And she didn't say a word. I think she thought it was a passing fad and I'd get over it and forget about it. When I was in grade 10, I said it again. And she said, well, you may as well forget about that because we don't have the money to send you.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought to myself, oh, it takes money. It hadn't occurred to me.
Sure.
And so for some reason, I never thought that I wasn't going to go. I was going to go. I just had to find my own way to do it. So I found that there was a scholarship at Wilfrid Laurier University that, you know, paid everything, tuition, accommodation, everything for 4 years if you could get above average 90% in grade 13.
Wow.
And so that was my only shot. And they only gave 6 of them out. And I thought, well, what if I had 90.1% and there were 6 people ahead of me? And so I better make this good. So I had an average of something like 95%, and I got one. And you had,
wow,
to keep, you had to keep your marks up to keep on getting it year by year. You had to keep an A-minus average. And I was in the library all the time. I had a real reputation. And I lived in there. And I made it through. And then I decided to go to journalism school at Western.
So after that's after your undergraduate degree?
Yes, I have 4 years undergraduate degree.
And then, so what did you study initially at Wilfrid Laurier?
I started in English literature and language.
And did you imagine yourself going into journalism, or did you think that you would be a teacher, or where? What was your plan at that time?
I, strangely enough, thought librarian, but oh my God. But, you know, I'd been writing these books. I'd been writing these books from the time forever. And when the dean of the School of Journalism saw these books, she said, Bev, you should be selling yourself as a sports journalist because there aren't many women in it.
Mm-hmm.
And you should be, you could sell yourself. And that's how I sold myself. And one day the Globe and Mail came to the journalism school and interviewed people. And the man was meeting me at the door and said, told me that if I, he had a job opening and covering sports or horse racing, I had it.
Wow.
And it was very difficult. They did very difficult interviews. It was not easy to please them. And so they hired me as a summer student.
Do you remember the trickiest question?
The trickiest question from...
That they asked you from that interview?
No, I don't remember any tricky questions at all. That's in the far recesses of my memory.
I know, and we haven't had our coffee, and I had car trouble. I totally get it. Now, what about... do you remember your first little book that you wrote for yourself when you were a kid?
I probably was grade 2. I had a pencil in my hand, and it wasn't a book. It was a little story about a cat, and I love cats. And I wrote a little story about a cat, and I was always writing stories and illustrating them.
And which did you prefer, the writing or the illustration?
I wanted to be an artist. I really wanted to be an artist when I started out. But I didn't want to starve because I knew what it was like not to have very much money.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought artists starved. So it's always been in the back burner of my life, and I've always wanted to bring it to the front burner. Sometime, when I've time.
Well, you know what's so interesting? When you talk about art and artistry, it completely makes sense, because one of my questions was going to be, how did you get led into figure skating, or led astray, as I would like
yes.
to say it? But if you have an aesthetic that is artistic, then you're going to be able to appreciate costumes and line and choreography in a way that somebody who's straight ahead horse racing might not. You know
Completely.
What I mean? So okay. How did you get led into figure skating?
Well, I've been riding horse racing, and I had this wonderful sports editor called Cece Jennings, who called me into his office one day, and he said to me, what would you like to write beside horse racing? And I thought for about 10 seconds, and I said, figure skating. And I didn't know anything about figure skating. All I knew, what I knew by osmosis. I knew who Tollar Cranston was. I knew who Karen Magnuson was. I knew who they were. But I said, figure skating. And he said, good, I'm glad you said that, because that's why I called you in here. I need somebody to write figure skating. I don't have anybody, and that's really what I wanted you to do. So he opened a huge door to me, and I grabbed it with both hands, and I didn't do it by halves. When I started, I thought I wanted to know everything there was to know about it, because I didn't want to have to depend on somebody to tell me what the jumps were or whether this was good or bad. So I learned the jumps on sight. I didn't have slow motion replay. I learned
yeah.
them on sight. And not being a skater myself, I had to really learn visually. And then I just wanted to know everything there was to know, and I put so much of my heart and soul into it, and so much of my own spare time over the years. It's sort of become a passion of mine. But that's sort of the way I do things.
Well, you aren't somebody who does things by halves, that's for sure. And, you know, when you and I first met, it was through my mom, who was a skating judge. And I can be a first-hand I can give people a first-hand account, a witness account, of having seen you at competitions that weren't covered by the Globe because you were interested in learning what was going on and what people were doing and how the rules affected things. So I remember seeing you for, you know, because we've known each other probably close to 20 years. And that would have been you paying your dues in the sport.
Yeah.
So what about figure skating? Are there any similarities as you cover one sport to the next?
It's funny because people look at me and say, horse racing, figure skating, are you kidding me? what possibly could be? But you know, horse racing is an interesting world because it's a whole little world unto itself, and it's a little community of people that are different from anything else, and they're totally fascinating, and there's a lot of beauty in it, and there's a lot of color in it, and that just so intrigued me so much. And horse racing to me is sort of like a microcosm of the real world, and so is figure skating. Because the struggles they go through are the struggles that you and I go through every day in your life, only magnified. Mm-hmm. Magnified many times because there's so much on the line. And I just find it endlessly, I find people endlessly fascinating and how they handle what they're going through. It's just endless to me, just endless fun to me in both respects.
Well, you know, when I think about horse racing, I think about the similarity between a race is only not very long, and it doesn't matter how well the horse ran in the warm-up. I don't know the correct terminology, but you know, in the practice runs or training runs or whatever, what really counts is when that bell goes off and those gates open and away they go. And figure skating is the same. Doesn't matter how well you practiced yesterday or today, you have to put it out there on the day.
Exactly.
Now, is there a lot of intrigue across the sports? We know that figure skating had its own scandal, of course, but what about in general? Is there intrigue?
Oh, there's always intrigue. Anytime you have people and they're running something or trying to create something, you know, they're jockeying for position and they're trying to do something, there's intrigue in everything. There's intrigue in journalism. There's intrigue everywhere. It's human nature.
What about human nature causes the intrigue?
Oh, you have all the vices. Come out. You have greed, you have, you know, people that, want to get somewhere quickly, make shortcuts, you want glory, you want something for your country, you want.
You know, I've always wondered, has there ever been there have been lots of times, I'm sure, but can you recall a time where you were stunned or shocked by a story, and how did you pursue it? Like when somebody gave you something unbelievable. I'll give you an example. When I was in Vancouver, one of my colleagues at CBC News phoned me to say that they'd heard from a friend, first cousin, times whatever, that Patrick Chan had been taken off a practice on a stretcher. And I said, that doesn't sound right. So, of course, it was just one of those kooky rumors.
Oh, you hear all kinds of kooky rumors. I know. You always have to sift through everything. And anytime somebody tells you something, you can't take it at face value. You have to put it through your sifter.
Right.
And relate it to what you know about this and about that. And that's why experience counts for so much. That's why it counts so much.
Well, you know, it was funny. In Vancouver, sort of 2 days later, same person phoned me and said, we understand that Johnny Rochette's mother has died. And I said, what are you talking about? And it was just, very soon after it had started to leak out, which was in the early hours of the morning. That story, of course, turned out to be true. So where do you get a nugget of information that you think is... can you give me an example of a nugget of information that you got from somewhere that just seemed so totally implausible, and next thing you know, it's a story? And how did you chase it?
World Figure Skating Championships in Lausanne, Switzerland. And I was tootling around, doing a little work for a network. And
is this 1997?
Yes.
Okay.
1997. I'm running out the door for something, and I run into the president of the Canadian Figure Skating Association, and she was all upset. And I looked at her, and she said, oh, my goodness, Carlo Fassi has just died. Carlo Fassi's just died. Like, oh, my God.
And he was a legendary coach.
He was a legendary coach, and he was there, and he just suddenly died. And so I went back to my people and I told them, and nobody knew anything about it. And Robin Cousins was working for BBC and he was sitting over the way. And he, of course, worked with Carlo and he had no idea. So basically it was from my information that he was told. And so then, of course, everything starts, you know.
And he had, in fact, died.
He had, in fact, died. And coming from the person that it came from, I had no doubt that it was true. I mean, how can you beat that? How can you beat a source like that? But there are lots of other sources. I hear this and I hear that. And it's so tough sometimes when you hear something, you really, really, really have to check it out and you have to get it corroborated and you have to, you know, I know a whole lot more than I've ever printed.
Well, and you know, what I have found along the way is that sometimes a seed will get planted in August, but I have to wait until the following February to have it actually be presented to me with enough corroboration that I'm actually able to say with confidence whatever it is.
Yes.
Like you can't, sometimes it's a bunch of different pennies that have to drop in a bunch of different locations before you kind of go, oh, that's what that is.
And here's another thing, something that happened to me at the Salt Lake City Olympics. Of course, that was wicked. That was just wicked. And I had already been writing stories about judging scandals before that came along, and I was focusing so much on what was happening in ice dance. And I wrote a story very soon after I got there that Born and Kratz were not going to win a medal at all in the ice dancing event. And then somebody told me, watch out for the French judge in the pairs event. And I sort of hadn't been looking at the pairs event. And so I kept that in the back of mind because you can't print rumors.
Yeah.
You can't prove something like that.
That's right.
You can't prove something that hasn't happened yet. And so the event happened and the flurry of the moment was going on and I had to write a story and get it filed really quickly, but it seemed like the results were kind of implausible. And then I looked at the marks. And the marks at that time, the judging system used at that time, you could read a whole story through the marks.
Sure.
And I could see that the French judge was the swing vote. And when I saw that and totaled them up and figured it out, I thought, oh, my God, it's happened. Oh, my God, it's happened. And so then, of course, you have to work on that. And so I wrote, I had two front page stories after that on the front page of the Globe and Mail, which I'm not sure whether that's happened too many times. And the next day I had, there were 100 media outlets apparently calling the Globe and Mail back in Toronto wanting interviews with me.
Oh, wow.
And I couldn't move. I couldn't go anywhere without people wanting to stop me and talk to me. And I was trying to focus on the next story.
Sure.
And it was very intense and everything was very distracting. And I had people calling me to interview in my hotel room. And I go to a press conference. I always love sitting in the front row because I don't want to miss anything. I'm sitting there. Press conference hasn't started yet. I'm sitting there waiting for it to start, and I'm chatting with somebody behind me, and I look up, and there's a TV camera focused on me, filming me. And I'm thinking, who is this guy? And I have no idea who he's from. And I think, well, okay, I know what he's doing. And how does he even know what I look like? Because I really haven't been on TV. I hadn't been on TV at all talking about it. But it was like that. And it was wild. It was just absolutely wild. And it sort of vindicated everything I'd done up to that point because I'd already been writing about this kind of stuff for years. And I think some people thought I was nuts.
Do you know what's so interesting about that whole story? I was one of the PA announcers in Salt Lake. And after the results came out, there was a whole lot of flurry on our particular desk. And the French judge, in fact, was prevented from leaving the platform during the medal ceremony, which was very interesting. So myself and the other announcer were kind of looking at each other going, what's going on here? But she was prevented from leaving. And I looked back at this woman and I kept thinking, oh, my goodness, she looks like she has a terrible headache. I thought, wow, that headache sure got worse very much more quickly.
And, you know, sometimes little clues like that are happening right in front of you and you have to be quick to notice that there's something unusual going on.
Yeah, and
little things like that.
It was subtle, but it was there. And the ire of the person that was sitting beside me, who was preventing her from leaving, I couldn't put two and two together. It didn't really make sense. It just was like, oh, come on. Anyway, but that whole experience was just insanity. Now, the thing that I found interesting about journalists versus Entertainment Tonight reporters, and there were both at that time, was that the Entertainment Tonight reporters, with no disrespect to Entertainment Tonight, but they were piggybacking on stories that were already said and already written. Many of that bunch were not doing any further research to try and advance the story. So that was the part that I found was a real eye-opener for me, because I always had taken everything written in the press and things that I saw in the news at face value. And it made me realize that reporters, journalists, writers, they're all human, and they all bring their own perspective to the table.
And they're all under pressure to produce.
Absolutely.
They're all under terrific pressure to produce, and you are supposed to be first with everything. And when somebody else has something, and then you're scrambling to match it, and too often they accept things at face value. And I think journalism is changing a lot, too, with the advent of the Internet and people going online and saying whatever they want in the face of anonymity. And I think there's a change now. And you really have to, you know, if you really stick to your guns and do things properly, you will stand out.
Mm-hmm.
If you do the work and you do the corroborating evidence and you do it for the right reasons, you will stand out. You will be different from all the rest that are kind of flooding around trying to just get something on air or something in the paper. And
just noise.
Yes, noise.
That's what I call
There's
it.
There's a lot of noise out there right now. A tremendous amount of noise, and you have to sift through it all.
So how do you know for sure that, is it just experience that allows you to rely on your sources? Like what do you have a secret spidey sense that says...
I do have a spidey sense. But you know what? It's experience, and it's being around for more than 30 years, and you know everybody, and you know what their game plan is, and you know what agendas they have, and you can sort of put it all together, but you have to question everything. And you know, like with the marks that I saw at Salt Lake City, oh my God, you know, there they were right in the paper. And yes, I do have great contacts from around the world that... trust my work and know that I'm... The other thing I've never wanted to do is twist a story to make it into something that it's not, just to get on the front page. I refuse to do that. Maybe that hasn't been good for my career at times. But I remember when I was a journalism student at Western, one of our jobs was to go over to the OPP and write little story. We go and interview the cops and write little stories and what they told us about some break-in or something. And I had written some little story about accident or something. I don't know what it was. And then I looked at the London Free Press the next day, and their story about the incident was totally different from mine. So the next time I went back in and visited this cop, I said to him, you know, why are those, did I get it wrong? Why was the story so different? He says, newspapers are like that. And that's what they do. And I said, well, I'm never going to do that. And he said, yes, you will. I said, oh, no, I won't. And he says, yes, you will. You all do it. You all have to do it. I said, no, I won't. And I've remembered that to this day. And I put my foot down and said, no, I won't.
Can you ever imagine going back to that cop and saying, hey, buddy, 30 years later, I just want you to know I never did?
Yes.
Would
I'd
be
love
fun,
to.
Eh?
I'd love to. Yeah.
So has there ever been a story that you wished you'd written?
Oh, my God.
She's weeping now, people. She's not really weeping. I'm kidding.
Oh, there are probably lots of them. I can't think of them off the top of my head at the moment. Oh, yeah, there are always stories I wish I'd written. Piles of them.
How much of it is there a percentage of luck, of being in the right place at the right time, that's involved with getting that good story?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Is there a time, give me an example of where you were, like Salt Lake is certainly a great example of being at the right place at the right time, but and Carla Fassi passing away also.
Running into the... president of the Figure Skating Association at the moment that I did. I just happened to run into her. Yeah, it's just chance that I happened to run out the door for that moment, because I was really, and I don't remember why I did. Maybe I was running out for something to eat. I don't know. But I had a job to do, and I ran out the door, and there she was.
So, people, what you have to understand from this is that reporters have to eat, too.
Sometimes we don't.
So how does the imagining of being right beside history happening compare to actually bearing witness to historical events? So when you were a little kid, you imagined, you know, you'd be a writer, or when you got, you know, into journalism school. How does the imagining of it compare to it?
When I was in grade 11, I figured out that the Globe and Mail had the best racing writers.
Mm-hmm.
and I was always... running around trying to get the Globe Mail. It wasn't always that easy, but there was a great big orange mailbox in the main street at Kincardine. And I remember walking up to it one day and said, I'm going to work for that newspaper someday.
Isn't that interesting?
And for me to say that at that time was completely ridiculous. I come from a town of 400. Nobody ever leaves. Nobody ever left.
And a woman. And a sports writer.
And a sports writer. And how was I going to get from
here to
where I was to there? And you know what? And I moved from a town of 400 to working for the Globe and Mail within 5 years. It was enough to make your head spin.
Wow.
And the culture shock. I remember the first time I drove on that ramp from the 427 to the Gardner. Oh, and I looked over that, and I hope my car doesn't go over. And like I'm a country bumpkin in the city, that's what I was. And
You know, when you have that first moment where your dreams come true in a way, do you ever stop to think, what am I doing here? What are they doing hiring me? Aren't I supposed to have like a corduroy jacket and leather patches on the elbow? I mean, you know, like the idea of what a writer is or a journalist is supposed to be or a writer is supposed to be. Did you match that up with who you were at that time? Or did you feel sort of like a bit of...
You know, when you're doing it, maybe you don't think of it because you're so busy working. But there are very many times that I sat down and thought, you know, I'm doing what I want to do. There's nowhere on the planet that I'd rather be than where I am right now. And I said that to myself many, many times. I just appreciated it so much because I certainly remember where I came from
mm-hmm.
and where I could have ended up. I could have been married to some farmer in Ripley.
Not that that's a bad thing.
No.
Nice ladies of Ripley. She means it in the nicest possible way. So tell me about what are your best qualities as a journalist and how has that helped you shape your career?
I think passion is the number one thing because I'm a very passionate, emotional person and I get involved. I get involved and I write that way and I think that comes across to people. I hope mm-hmm. it does. And I'm a stickler for detail. This is me again, not doing things by halves. And detail makes good stories. You know, it's not enough just to write somebody one something, but, you know, I I'm a visual person too, because I'm mm-hmm. sort of an artist and I always want to draw pictures of what I'm seeing and being there. And, I think that works really well for me.
So tell me about, you know, when I write things, from time to time, I have favorites. And sometimes I like, you know, playing with the words long, you know, and they'll make me kind of giggle when I'm writing stuff. And sometimes it's hard for me to publish it because I kind of want to keep it. But sometimes there are pieces that I've written of which I'm very proud. A few, not a lot, but a few. Tell me about any of the pieces. You must have a whole bunch, but give me one that springs to mind that you're proud of.
You know, I just...
It'd be nice if I could ask the question without...
there are lots of them, but, you know, I just finished writing a figure skating book. I'm hoping to have it published by the fall, and I've written about 40 biographies of the top skaters in the world, and there were some chapters that just went down on the paper like I couldn't believe it, and I really like what went down on the paper, and sometimes it just comes,
mm-hmm.
and sometimes you have to work really hard at it, but there were... I'm trying to think of any particular one, but I wrote a chapter on Pechelat and Borzat,
mm-hmm.
and they're always they're oddballs. And believe me, I love oddballs. I just love them to bits because they
just
give me so
friends.
Much. Yeah, that's exactly true. And you know, it gives you so much color to work with. There was another story that I wrote about the racetrack, about various people at the racetrack. There's so much color. There was a trainer that was just kind of Jerry Meyer. He was different, and he died, and I wrote an obituary on him, but it wasn't like an obituary that you'd think of. It wasn't boring. It was, I went to talk to people about the kind of things he did, and, you know, he was buried with his binoculars. He always has binoculars with him. He was buried with his binoculars. And it's so much fun. And then there was another guy at Woodbine, and my little feelers just went up when this happened, but I heard that the guy in charge of the jockey's colors had died at Woodbine.
Now, what are the jockeys' colors, if people don't know?
They're the jockeys wear these colored silks that represent the owner. The owner represents colors.
Okay.
And every time a horse goes out there, they wear a certain color.
Okay.
And so you can identify the horse by the colors the jockeys are wearing. And in that jockey's room, there are 12,000 jockey silks hanging on a dry clean-like thing that whirls around. And
really?
The guy sits there. And this guy knew every single color and where to find it. He had a photographic memory, and, you know, there's a little foot pad that he pressed, and these things would go whirring around, and they'd say, I want to see Jean-Louis Levesque's colors. And maybe Jean-Louis Levesque hadn't had a horse race in 20 years, but he hit the thing, and he wouldn't even look. And the thing would whir around and stop, and there would be Jean-Louis Levesque's colors.
Wow.
Well, he died. And it was his own system, and nobody could find the colors the next day.
Oh,
and they were all scrambling. And I just knew that there was a story there, and I was itching to do it, and I was trying to tell my boss about it, and he wasn't interested. He sent me off to the tennis at York University, and I had to report there by 6 and cover Rafael Nadal, which was great, but there's no way that I could not do this story. So I thought to myself, well, isn't Woodbine on the way to York University? And so I showed up at Woodbine at like 10:30 or 11 in the morning to talk to the clerk of the scales, who was the boss of this guy. And this guy is a very emotional guy, and it turned out he'd been up all night trying to find colors, because before every race there are pegs.
Oh, I see.
So that the jockeys can grab them right away, because there's not much time between races.
Sure.
You have them all laid out on pegs for every race, and you have to pull them all out. They couldn't find them. This guy could do it in an hour. These people had about 6 people or 9 people working on it all night to pull them.
Oh, my.
And sometimes they just couldn't find them, so sometimes there were horses not wearing the right colors. So he'd been up all night, and I thought, oh, my God, he's kind of grouchy anyway. And he's not going to want to talk to me. But when I told him what I wanted, out came all this emotion, and it was just amazing stuff.
Aww.
It was just amazing stuff. So I wrote the story, and I won a Sovereign Award with it.
Wonderful.
But it was, I just...
You've won 2 Sovereign Awards.
I've won 4.
4? I'm sorry. Sorry, people.
Yeah.
4, that's amazing.
Yeah, 4.
All for horse racing, right?
All for horse racing.
That's
horse
amazing.
Racing in the country. They're part of their Horse of the Year Awards. They're National Horse of the Year Awards, and there are media categories in there. So
this man unleashed all of his sort of sadness
and so much color about this guy, and of course I went and talked to some jockeys back in the back room, and they were talking about how they'd come in the morning. And of course this the clerk of the scales and this color man had an apparently nasty relationship. They did show insults at each other all the time, but it was because they liked each other. And oh my goodness, it was just great stuff. It was fantastic stuff.
In all your years of skating, that kind of fractious relationship is kind of interesting to me. Have you ever noticed, has there ever been a pair, a dance team, coach and skater that you've seen that kind of relationship that you've gone, that's odd?
Oh, probably. I remember back in the days of...
I think of Toller and Mrs. Burka when I think of that. Just
yes.
Like a completely...
and it's still going on.
Yes, it is.
It's still going on. I'm not sure they speak to each other at the moment.
They don't.
And yes. And yes. But there are personalities that collide, and they're always there. And I remember even, just off the top of my head, Tracy Wilson and Rob McCall, when they skated together, 2 completely different people. Absolutely.
Yep.
Totally. And Tracy would be the kind of person who would be on time and very organized.
And a planner.
And a planner.
Yep.
And Rob, he was like, he was a free spirit.
Yeah.
And he might be late. He might be, he might be making jokes about the wide mouth frog and all sorts of things. And so there's obviously probably some friction there at one time, but they did work it out.
Yep.
And you hear this time and time again of young dance teams or pair teams when they first get together and they start fighting, and then they realize that they really just can't fight. They have to get along. And I've heard that story so many times. And actually, there's a Russian ice dancing team, Elinik and Katsalapov, who actually split up for a while because they were fighting all the time. And she actually went to the United States and was working for a while under Igor Shpilban with a skater that wasn't as good as her previous partner, and she ended up going back, and they got together, and she realized she needed him, and so they resolved that problem. But I think any time you have 2 people together and they have personalities, you can easily get conflict, especially when you're working and things are intense and you want to be perfect, or somebody else doesn't want to be perfect.
Yeah, it's interesting. Why do you think sports are important?
I think they show, to me,
mm-hmm.
Sports are interesting because it's life in a neat little bow. Well, it's not a neat little bow, but it's sports is a microcosm of life,
mm-hmm.
but it's intense, and you're going through things and you're experiencing things and you're challenging yourself and seeing how far you can push yourself with all kinds of people watching you. and how do you handle it? And I always learn from what skaters go through. I always apply it to myself because I think that's what sport is to me.
Okay, so let's talk, change gears a tiny little bit. Social media, Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, all the rest of them. Better for worse. What are the two sides of the coin?
It is what it is.
Right.
It's here and it's happening and you have to embrace it. And it's changing the whole media world.
Tell me how you think so. I think so too.
Everything has to be quick. Everything has to be short. You aren't going to get time to tell the whole story. So you have to wrap it up in 140 letters. The information is very surface-like. Can be very surface-like. People are very busy now.
Mm-hmm.
They don't have time to sit down and read features that run for pages. Maybe sometimes they do if they're compelling enough. But it's a whole different ball of wax, and it is what it is. Mm-hmm. So you have to go with it. There's no going back.
It's interesting. I've talked to different people who, not in media at all, who've talked about, I don't like Facebook and I'm not going to do Twitter and I don't have a computer. And I think, well, that's kind of like saying, I'm not going to use the telephone.
Yes.
You know, at a certain point, you have to roll with it. You're right.
Yes.
And you have to figure out how you're going to be with it and how it's not going to take you over, because it really can. I mean, you
Absolutely.
Can spend more time on social media than actually doing the work that you should be.
I have a bad habit of getting on my computer before I go to bed, and I look up and it's past midnight and think, oh, I should have gone to bed earlier. And, you know, you get involved in it, you get into it, and you start reading things, and you want to check up on this, and you want to see that, and you want to see the photos you've downloaded the other day, you want to have another look at those again, and before you know it, do the slideshow and blah, 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 and it's 1 o'clock in the morning.
That whole 1 o'clock in the morning really sneaks up on a person.
Oh, it does the next day. I can't write when I'm tired.
Can you not?
Oh, I can't.
You have to be rested?
I have to be rested.
So the Olympics are coming again, and for people who haven't ever been to an Olympic Games, and you've been to 5 or 6?
Oh, a pile of them.
A whole pile of them.
Yeah.
What is the schedule like for a journalist at the Olympics?
Oh, well, I'll tell you what I did at the Sydney Olympics in Australia. I was working on 5 hours sleep a night.
Oh, my.
And I had to cover the rowing. I love covering rowing. I absolutely love that sport. And I would be getting out of my bed at 4:30 in the morning and getting my stuff together, and I'd be walking through the darkness to the dining room. And Sydney was great because the whole media village was one great big village, and the whole media contingent was in one place, and they had a couple of dining halls. So I'd walk through the dark, hoping the poisonous spiders wouldn't jump out and bite me in the leg on my way there. And actually, it was such a big complex that I got lost for 3 days before I figured out how to get to my place. But after 3 days, I was okay. And so I'd be walking through the darkness, and then I'd jump on a bus, and it would take you out to the boonies, a couple hours ride, and you get there, and I was always there. The races start at 8 in the morning, so I was always there early, because that's just me.
Yep.
And one of the first people there, and I'd sit down, get organized, and be relaxed, and I'd cover it, and then I'd go on to something else, and then I'd go on to something else, and then I'd go on to something else, and when I was finished, I went to bed, and I have 5 hours sleep, if I was lucky.
So transmitting your pieces at that time, did you rely on the internet at that time? Because it still was very early-ish for...
Yes, and we filed a lot to a website at that time. It was the first time we made a great use of the website because of the time difference.
Okay.
If we wanted to make the paper, we had to have things in by probably 11:30. And the rest of the day...
PM or...
AM.
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 Okay.
And the rest of the day... The stuff just went on the website. And by the way, that stuff was never saved into a database. So it's all out in the Ethernet. Stuff I did is in the Ethernet. It's out in the,
it's gone in the cosmos.
Up in the heavens, yes, in the cosmos. And, it was just work. And I loved every minute of it. That was Sydney.
And before the Internet, how did you get us, if you were across the world covering figure skating in 1983, how did you get a story back to here? Telex? Fax?
Laptops. We had laptop. I remember when I started at the Globe, I used a typewriter, a manual typewriter. And they used fax machines that would only send a page at a time. So you'd have to write it and, you have to correct your spelling mistakes and send this thing. And it would take 6 minutes to send a page. And then they got this great invention, the computer. And the thing was so bloody heavy, you could barely carry the thing.
I think I remember meeting you when you had your first computer, and it was like a doorstop. It was huge.
It was huge. And it was heavy as all get out. And I remember covering a horse race at Flamborough Downs one time and carrying that thing in. And the media room was up three flights of stairs. And I got it up there and set it down. And I was in deadline, and the race was over, and it was tight in deadline. And it blew up. I carried it all the way up there for nothing, and I had to carry it all the way back down again. So this thing was monstrous, and you could only send a screen at a time. And you have to write it and then send the next screen. How do you ever have flow through your story doing that? And then they got the porta bubbles. And I remember being at a Canadian championship in North Bay where the rink was under construction, and there was a piece of plywood between us and the rink, and you could hear the noise. It was really loud in there. And that poor thing interfered with my porta bubble.
So what is a porta bubble?
It was a smaller, lighter version of it. And you take a phone, an actual phone, and stick it into the top, because there were these couplers that sort of received both ends of the phone.
Yep.
So, you know, if you'd stick it in there, so the noise could interfere with the transmission. So I'd be throwing my coats over top of it. And you know, if it didn't send right, you have to send again, and you're on deadline. And so I've seen the whole gamut of the technology change.
So we will be able to agree on the fact that it's probably easier today to get stuff across the world.
Oh, it's a snap.
But before, it was definitely, it's like I talked to photographers who would talk about having to shoot the stuff, develop the stuff, then in some way transmit it. And it was just,
yeah,
it
they
was
used to
a
have,
lot
they
of work.
They used to have dark rooms at figure skating competitions. They used to have dark rooms.
Unbelievable. And yeah. That wasn't because the coaches needed a nap.
Yes.
Although that could have been. Tell me what you think. So you're entering a new phase into your career. What are you going to write for fun? Like, is writing fun for you still?
Writing and reporting is fun for me. It's my life. It really was my life. I put my whole self into it, and it's my whole life, and there's no way that I can stop.
Mm-hmm.
But at this stage of my life, I want to do what I want to do. I want to do things that make me happy, and that's sports. Figure skating, horse racing, rowing, Olympic sport. That's where I'm going.
Well, if you had three qualities that you could divide. Apparently I speak for a living. Can you say that? I would like you to give me three qualities that describe you.
Passionate, of course. Perfectionist. And fair.
Okay, you know what? I want to go back to something that you talked about earlier, and that is Black Stallion, because I, of course, read Black Stallion, Black Beauty, all of the horse books, because I was a really horsey little girl. So tell me about that, because that story that book seemed to be of special significance to you.
The Black Stallion book started everything. That's what gave me the idea to start writing in the first place. And the Black Stallion was written by this man called Walter Farley. He was an American. And I picked up that book when I was in public school in Ripley, and read it and thought, wow, that's a fantastic book. And then I found another one, Son of the Black Stallion, and I read that too. And in the front of the book, there was a list of all the books that Walter Farley had written, and there must have been 20 of them. And I thought, how am I going to read those? But you won't find those in the libraries of Ripley, Ontario. So I thought, well, I'm going to have to buy them. I'm going to have to buy them one by one. I had an allowance of 25 cents a week at the time. And there was a bookshop in Kincardine called Henry's Book and China Shop. He sold china and he sold books. And I'd go in there and I'd order these Black Stallion books from Random House of New York, and I'd save up the money and buy two or three at a time. And I eventually got the whole collection. And, you know, it took me years. And they were beautiful hardcover books and illustrated by artists. And I thought these books were so compelling, the writing was so compelling, that I wanted to know what he did that made it so interesting. So I would go through the books with a fine-tooth comb and write down phrases that particularly appealed to me. And I based my writing style on Walter Farley.
Wow.
He was my hero. And so after I started working for the Globe and Mail, I had to cover the World Dressage Championships in Cedar Valley. And just, you know, sort of north of Toronto. And I was in the main media area. And there was technology is really bad these days. If you wanted to leave a message for somebody, there was a bulletin board in the media area. And I'm checking the bulletin board to see if there are any messages for me. And there was a message for Walter Farley in the board, and my heart just stopped. So I went up to one of the volunteers in charge of the meeting room at the time, and I said, I just saw a message for Walter Farley in that board. Is he actually here? And she said, who? And I thought, oh, my God, how can she be interested in horses and not know who Walter Farley is? So I explained it, and I told her that, you know, this man, I have to meet this man this week. If I do not meet him, I will not live, I will die. And
not that you're dramatic or anything.
I'm passionate.
Yeah, I forgot.
I'm passionate. So the head of the media liaison team actually found him the next day and brought him back and introduced him to me.
What was he doing there?
He was just
a fan?
Just a fan.
Hmm.
He wasn't writing anything. He had media accreditation, but he was never really in the meeting room. He was just there. He liked horses. He tootled around all over the place with horse stuff and got himself into the most unbelievable places. And anyway, he was an elderly man at the time, and white hair and a tweed cap, and I told him my story. I told him how I'd based my writing style and everything. He took a shine to me. And all I wanted to do was meet him. That would have been enough for me. That would have been life's best
sure.
thing ever granted to me. And so he took me out to dinner that night, and he drove this little red Honda with a license plate that said, I heart the Black Stallion. And we went out and had dinner, and he gave me his home addresses and phone numbers in Pennsylvania and Florida. He had two places, Pennsylvania and Florida. So we kept in touch, and we wrote each other. Mm-hmm. And if I didn't answer his letters soon, he'd sort of get upset with me. But on one occasion, I didn't hear from him for a while. And he'd always told me that, you know, he really liked my writing at Cedar Valley, and that if I ever wanted to write a book, he'd get me in at Random House of New York. But I was too young then. I didn't have a book in me. But he was always telling me that. So I didn't hear from him. So I called the farm in Pennsylvania, and somebody answered the phone and said, oh, no, he's down Florida. Phone Florida. So I phoned Florida, and his wife answered the phone, and she says, oh, I'm sorry. Walter's had a stroke, and he's not taking calls.
Oh.
And I'm sorry, I didn't know. And she said, just wait a minute. So I'm sitting on the phone thinking, why am I waiting? And a few minutes went by. The next thing I knew, Walter was on the phone.
Oh.
He took my call. And I guess the stroke didn't affect his speech, but he talked to me for about 10 minutes. And then he said, you know, I'm getting really tired. I have to go now. But I want you to promise me one thing. And I said, what? And he said, please don't forget me.
Ah.
And I thought, well, yeah, of course. And so after that, I never heard from him again because he died shortly after that. So I knew him just in time. I only knew him for about 3 years. So when I wrote my third figure skating book, I've written in the front, to Walter Farley, my kind mentor, who I will never forget. So I finally wrote that book. It wasn't a racing book, but it was my best figure skating book, talking figure skating. And
Walter Farley, we're thinking of you today.
Yes, he's up there.
Do you know what, Bev? Thank you so much for sharing that story and for talking to me today. This has just been wonderful.
It's been my pleasure.
Thank you.
Okay, Paul, what did you think?
Well, it's always nice to hear the stories behind all of these different people and what sort of, inspired them or influenced them to sort of go on to work in the field that they have been.
Well, and what I found so inspirational about Bev's story was the fact that, you know, she was dreaming about things that she couldn't even really put a name to. I mean, she came from this very small town. She wanted to go to university, and she found a way to make it happen. So I find that whole thing very inspirational. And, you know, when she talked about the story about the Black Stallion, the author of The Black Stallion, and getting a chance to meet him, what I did ask her at the very end, which I forgot to record, was if, in fact, she still had this full series of books, you know, that she talked about saving the money and getting them sent to her sort of one and two at a time. And she does have those books, and they're very prominently displayed in her home. And people actually aren't allowed to take them out and read them because there's such a huge sentimental value attached to them. So that, as much as anything, tells me a lot about the depth of feeling and passion that Bev Smith has for writing. It was really, it was wonderful to be able to have her share those stories with me. So speaking of sharing, Paul, if people want to share with us, how do they get a hold of us?
Check us out on Facebook. We have a nice page up there, and like us, and we'll like you back, maybe.
No, we will. We will. I'm good that way.
And on Twitter at Open Kwong Door, and you can email us, contact at openkwongdoor.com, and the website openkwongdoor.com, and that's it.
See you next time.